Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and features from around the world is designed for people learning English. Today on the show, we hear another everyday grammar program from Alice Bryant. She tells us about more ways to express like and dislike in English. We close the program with another segment of our American History series, The Making of a Nation. Steve Ember and Richard Rail look at the first and only term of President Rutherford B. Hayes. He took office in 1877. But first, it is cherry blossom season in Washington, D.C. Every year, the nation's capital celebrates the beautiful trees, especially those that line the tidal basin. They are a well-loved gift from the nation of Japan. However, there are less famous but equally pleasing cherry trees to explore in a large and extraordinary green space inside the city. Reporter Ashley Thompson takes us there.
Each year at the start of spring, more than 1 million people travel to Washington, D.C. for one major reason: the cherry blossoms. Most of the travelers visit an area known as the Tidal Basin. During peak bloom, the Tidal Basin is bursting with color. It is also bursting with people. But there is another, quieter way to enjoy Washington's cherry blossoms. About 8 kilometers across town, you will find the United States National Arboretum, a huge public garden and research collection. The United States Congress established the Arboretum in 1927. Its aim is to use research and conservation to improve the appearance and environmental and economic value of plants. Cherry tree research is one of the Arboretum's specialties, says Margaret Pooler. She is the director of research. She and her team work on developing a larger base of cherry trees.
Most people know the Yoshino cherries. They know the Kwanzaan cherries, the familiar ones that you see down at the Tidal Basin. But what a lot of people don't realize is that there's so many other species that we can use to broaden the base of the cultivated plants that we see. And so that's what we're trying to do.
Today, the Arboretum has more than 1,000 different cherry trees. Some are short and wide. Others grow tall. A few are weeping trees. Their long, flowering branches hang down near the ground. Pooler showed VOA Learning English around the Arboretum's research field. In late March and early April, this wide, open space comes to life with flowering cherry trees. Some produce bright white blooms. Others are different shades of pink. Many of them are new species of cherry trees developed by Arboretum scientists themselves. They are hybrid cherry trees, Pooler explains.
In our research program, we create hybrids. That is, we take pollen from one plant and put it on another plant to combine the best traits from both of those. And so most of the plants here in our research field are various hybrids of that kind that we've created.
Most of the hybrids are known only by number. But scientists have given some hybrids names, such as Dreamcatcher and First Lady. One cherry hybrid is called Helen Taft, in honor of the wife of former U.S. President William Howard Taft. She played an important role in bringing cherry trees to America.
The really, really good ones, those are the ones that we end up naming and we release to the public to then grow and produce.
Pooler has worked on cherry trees at the Arboretum for more than 20 years. She lists two weeping trees as among her favorites there.
I like them because they're just huge. I mean, they're just awesome trees. But I like them also because they tend to not bloom very long. But when they're in bloom, they're just spectacular.
The Arboretum has a self-guided tour of its cherry trees. People can use a small book to learn about the different species. The book describes about 35 kinds of cherry trees. Among them are genetic matches of a few of the original trees that were planted at the Tidal Basin in 1912. The trees were a gift to the United States from Japan.
Very few of those original plants still exist there. We got involved with the National Park Service a few years ago to help propagate or clone some of those original plants. So we have some of those planted here.
Antonio and Marlene are from Spain and now live in the state of Maryland. They visited the Arboretum with their two young children and had a picnic near one of the flowering trees. The family had gone to the Tidal Basin earlier that day to see the cherry blossoms as well.
Here you see nature around, which is like better, better than... I prefer Arboretum than Tidal Basin.
Emily Kowalski and Elizabeth Seberg had just arrived in Washington from Minnesota. They came straight from the airport to the Arboretum to see the cherry trees, Kowalski said.
There's this one that we just kind of walked up upon, and from afar, just the view from afar, you can't even take a picture of it because it's just something you have to take in with your own eyes.
Whether at the Arboretum, Tidal Basin, or elsewhere, cherry blossoms are a special part of life in America's capital. Along with being beautiful to look at, the trees are something Washingtonians can count on every year, Pooler says.
Even when the spring is late or drawn out or cold, or even when winter is, you know, freezing cold and our temperatures are terrible, we know, no matter what happens, even, you know, things are happening in Washington politically, it doesn't matter. These cherries are going to bloom every year. We can totally count on them.
I'm Ashley Thompson.
English speakers express likes and dislikes in so many ways. By now, you've learned how to use words such as like, enjoy, love, or even hate. For example,
she really likes the new professor.
We enjoy restaurants by the water.
I love traveling to distant places.
They hate cold weather and snow.
These are simple and common ways to express likes and dislikes, but fluent speakers of English use other ways too. Some are a little more nuanced and less direct. Today, we'll show you four phrases you can start using as soon as you like. Let's start with to be into. This phrase is very informal, and American English speakers often include the adverb really in it. To be really into something means you like it a lot. One structure for using this phrase is subject plus the verb to be plus the like or dislike word or phrase plus a noun. Listen.
I'm really into karaoke. I sing in front of crowds every chance I get.
But what if you wanted to express that someone is really into doing something? The structure changes a little. Listen.
I'm really into singing pop songs from the 80s.
Here, it's subject plus the verb to be, plus the like or dislike word or phrase, plus a gerund and sometimes a noun. The gerund in this example is singing, and songs is the noun. All the phrases you'll hear today can be used with either of these two structures. The negative form of the phrase, to not really be into, does not exactly mean someone has a strong dislike for something. It may just mean the person has little or no interest in it. Listen.
He's not really into baseball, but he loves soccer. Maybe you guys can catch a soccer game?
Let's move on to the next one. Like the phrase, to be really into, to be a fan of something means you like it a lot. Americans usually add the adjective big or huge to this phrase. One thing to note, you may have heard people say they are fans of a sports team or of a movie star. These are common ways to use fan, but you can be a fan of just about anything. Listen.
I'm a big fan of sushi. I know a great Japanese place we can go to.
Notice this example uses the first structure we discussed. Also, with this phrase, sometimes the word fan comes after the thing that you like. Listen.
I'm a big sushi fan. I know a great Japanese place we can go to.
When we use the negative form, not a big fan of, it expresses a stronger emotion than saying you're not really into it. Listen.
I've never been a huge fan of shopping at supermarkets. They're too crowded. I prefer to order my groceries online.
Notice that this example uses have been, which is a tense of the verb to be. It also uses the second structure we discussed earlier. For the rest of the program, you can examine the sentence structure yourself. Remember, all the phrases today follow one of these two patterns. Now, let's talk about the phrase to be crazy about. This phrase's positive and negative forms have very different uses. In American English, we use the positive form much less frequently. And it is mainly used to express strong romantic feelings for someone.
He's crazy about her. I think he's going to ask her to marry him.
We also sometimes use it for activities such as sports or the arts.
My kids are crazy about football. They're going to football camp this summer.
An older way of saying the phrase used the preposition for instead of about.
He's crazy for opera. He buys tickets every season, no matter how much they cost.
Now to the negative. We almost always use the negative form for non-romantic things. It means the same as to not be a fan of. Listen.
I'm not crazy about mowing lawns. I usually pay someone to do the job for me.
Our last phrase for today, to be fond of, is mostly used for food and people. This phrase is generally more common in British English, but its negative form is fairly common in the United States. To be fond of means having a liking or love for someone or something. Listen.
She's been fond of that boy since they were babies.
The negative form means you don't like something. Listen.
Mark has never been fond of vegetables. I don't think I've ever seen him touch a salad.
Of course, there are many more ways to express likes and dislikes in English. But learning these four phrases is a good start. Don't forget that you can still freely use the words you've already been using, like, enjoy, love, and others. These new phrases just give you more options. And if you're a big fan of learning English, well then, give them a try. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Rutherford Hayes was sworn into office as the 19th President of the United States in 1877. Hayes, a Republican, became president after a disputed election. Representatives of his party and the Democrats met secretly to work out a compromise. The Democrats agreed to let Hayes be sworn in. In return, he agreed to end federal support of radical Republican governments in the South. He promised to name Southerners to his cabinet and other important jobs. And he said he would provide more federal aid for schools and railroads in the South. As part of the agreement, Hayes promised not to act aggressively to support the civil rights of black Southerners. Steve Ember and Richard Rail tell the story of Rutherford Hayes.
Rutherford Hayes was born in Ohio in 1822. He was a good student at Kenyon College and at Harvard Law School. He opened a law office in Cincinnati. When he was 30 years old, he married Lucy Webb. Later, he served as an officer in the Union Army during America's Civil War. He was elected to the United States House of Representatives. He also served as governor of Ohio. In this job, he helped establish the college that became Ohio State University.
Hayes was a Republican. In 1876, he was the party's compromise candidate for president. His opponent in the national election was Democrat Samuel Tilden. Tilden won more popular votes than Hayes. In the American political system, whoever wins the most popular votes in a state usually gets all the electoral votes of that state. In 1876, both the Republicans and Democrats claimed the electoral votes of three southern states, Florida, Louisiana, and South Carolina. So it was not clear at first who had won the presidential election.
Congress appointed a committee to decide the issue. The committee had a Republican majority. It gave the disputed electoral votes to Hayes. He won the election by just one electoral vote. The results came just a few days before the inauguration. Democrats protested that the Republicans had stolen the election. Yet they agreed to accept Hayes as president. In exchange, Hayes and the Republicans agreed to accept Democratic Party policies on several issues. Hayes's administration would deal mainly with national, not international, problems.
At first, people wondered, would President Hayes keep the promises that were made to help him win the election, most thought he would not. Hayes surprised everyone. In his inaugural speech, he promised to put the country ahead of the party. He said, "He serves his party best who serves his country best." Party leaders told Hayes which men to appoint to his cabinet. He refused and made his own choices. He ordered federal troops to withdraw from South Carolina and Louisiana. The troops had been there since the end of the Civil War. He also helped Southern Democrats establish new governments in their states.
Republican Party leaders criticized President Hayes. Anti-slavery groups also criticized him. They said former black slaves in the South had gained a lot under Republican rule. Now, they said, these black Americans would lose everything. Hayes did not agree. He had received promises that the new Democratic state governments would protect the rights of black Americans. It was not to be. White Democrats kept political control in some southern states for many years. They often denied civil rights to black citizens. Only with the rise of the civil rights movement in the 1950s would the situation begin to change.
After becoming president, Rutherford Hayes announced that he would serve just one term. He wanted to make serious reforms in the federal government. This would be easier to do if he did not have to worry about getting reelected. Hayes started by changing the system that employed people in government jobs. Party leaders usually had great power to fill government jobs. They used the jobs to reward loyal party workers and to increase their own political strength. President Hayes demanded that federal jobs be given to people because of their abilities, not because they supported a politician.
At that time, the best jobs were with the Customs Service of the Treasury Department. The people who collected customs, taxes on imports, could keep part of the money they collected. President Hayes took action against the Customs Service office in New York City. One of the men removed from the job there was James Garfield. Garfield would later become president of the United States. Hayes also banned all federal workers from taking part in political organizations, conventions, and campaigns. And he said politicians no longer could demand campaign money from federal workers.
Rutherford Hayes showed more political strength during a nationwide railroad strike. The strike began during his first summer as president. For several years, the nation had suffered from a serious economic depression. 3 million people were out of work. Factories and businesses reduced the pay of those who still had jobs. Workers with the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad protested. They took control of many areas along the railroad. They refused to let the trains move. The strike spread to other railroads. In some places, the strikes turned into riots, and the riots became violent. Some governors ordered their state armed forces to intervene. The state forces were not strong enough, however. So the governors asked President Hayes for help. He immediately sent federal troops to troubled cities. The troops stopped the riots and ended the strikes.
Another issue during Hayes's administration
involved a railroad in the western United States. It was both a labor problem and an immigration problem. Thousands of Chinese workers had been brought to America to help build the Central Pacific Railroad. After the railroad was built, many of them remained. Most settled in California. Others came from China to join them. These immigrants competed with white workers for jobs. Whites protested because the Chinese agreed to work for less money. They said this kept wages down for all workers.
The white workers asked Congress for a law to stop Chinese workers from coming to the United States. Members of Congress from both parties wanted the support of these voters, so they quickly passed a bill that made it much more difficult for Chinese citizens to come to live in the United States. The bill said the president must cancel part of a treaty between the United States and China. That part of the treaty permitted citizens of each country to settle in the other country.
President Hayes vetoed the bill. He said the United States had proposed the treaty. So, he said, the United States could not change it without agreement from China. Hayes did agree, however, that some action was necessary. So he opened negotiations with the Chinese government. He won an agreement to limit the number of Chinese who could enter the United States.
During the administrations of Andrew Johnson and Ulysses Grant, Congress had weakened many powers of the president. Congress had become the strongest of the three branches of American government. Throughout his administration, Rutherford Hayes worked hard to strengthen presidential powers. For example, the United States Constitution gives the president power to veto bills passed by Congress. In the 1800s, Congress tried to prevent presidential vetoes. It used a method of attaching riders to legislative proposals. This is how the method works.
Congress considers a bill the president believes is necessary. Then it joins that bill to a measure the president would veto if passed separately. The extra measure is called a rider to the first bill. To get the bill he wants, the president must accept the rider, too. President Hayes refused to sign any bills with riders. So the Congress, during his administration, stopped using the method. Congresses since then have used it successfully.
Rutherford Hayes kept his promise to serve only 4 years. He did not regret his decision. After leaving office in 1881, he said he was satisfied with what he had done. He looked back on his administration and wrote, "I left this country prosperous and happy. I left the party of my choice strong, victorious, and united. In serving the country, I served my party." He died in 1893.
Hayes was right in saying that the United States was strong and prosperous. The late 1800s were a time of growth for the nation. They also were a time of expansion into new territory.
We have come to the end of today's show, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.